Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
During the summer when the weather gets hot, I can only imagine how much time you plan to spend outside with friends or alone on your couch with that AC blasting. AT&T 5G and home internet keeps you connected, so you can enjoy all the summertime vibes, whether you're sharing pics from a rooftop, video calling your friends from an outdoor concert, or streaming your favorite show, episode after episode. So, stay connected to your favorite people and your favorite things with AT&T 5G and home internet. AT&T 5G requires compatible plan and device. Coverage not available everywhere. Learn more at att.com/5G for you.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today I wanted to start with a question. I'm going to try to do my best Big Lebowski voice. What makes a mammal? Thinking about mammals, what are a few common features of mammals? Of course, we know that all mammals are vertebrates, along with birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish. They got the backbone going on. Mm-hmm. Mammals, along with birds, are, of course, endothermic or warm-blooded, which that can sometimes be a misnomer because, as we've discussed before, there are cases where mammals can cool their bodies down quite a bit.
Right.
Most mammals, excluding monotremes, have live births rather than laying eggs. Mammals generally have hair as opposed to scales or feathers.
Right, unless they've lost that hair by becoming aquatic creatures.
Or for reasons yet unknown.
Right, or for living underground, etc., yeah.
Yeah. And then we get to the big one. Of course, it is that mammals nurse their young with milk. And
that's
this
right.
is one of the real miracles of nature.
It is really. I mean, we're not just saying that because milk has such an important role in human child rearing, or because humans have this weird thing where we drink the milk of other species,
mm-hmm.
Especially around the holidays. You know, this is kind of a slightly holiday themed episode because a lot of people drink eggnog, boiled custard type drinks, which are more traditionally milk based.
Is eggnog a dairy product? I thought it was made with eggs. I have no idea.
Oh, yeah. There's cream in there. I mean, obviously, if you can get the soy nog, which I have memories of being tasty. And yet this year I picked
up.
Yeah, I have memories. I saw it in the store. I got kind of excited. I got a particular carton of soy nog, brought it back home to share with my son, who's six. And he said, oh, this is good. This tastes like wet, cold sugar. And I was like, yeah, it does kind of taste like wet, cold sugar. It doesn't have this particular – I don't want to damn all soy nog because I have to be remembering something real.
Uh-huh.
But this particular one, yeah, did not have that fatty, creamy finish to it.
Anything but like normal full fat milk products always does have a kind of strange sweetness to it. Do you ever notice the odd sweetness of skim milk? There's something that feels a little off about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I've had skim milk. I do tend to just use like soy milk, almond milk, coconut milk, that kind of thing these days. Mm-hmm. And thus my desire to get in the Christmas spirit by buying soy nog.
Right. But so, okay, it's not just the role in human culture that we use the milk of other animals in our cuisine, which is pretty much objectively weird. I think that's one of those things aliens would come to Earth and see us doing and think was weird. But it's also that it's a deep part of what we are as an animal. The possession of mammary glands and the rearing of children with milk is that's like a main morphological feature of what it means to be a mammal. The word mammal basically means like breast beast.
Yeah, we are a bunch of breast beasts, really. So yes, it nourishes our offspring, and in doing so helps to establish immune system competence as well. Now, the exact nutrient composition of milk is going to vary across species, and it also can change quite a bit depending on the different stages of lactation, which is something that's easy to overlook. Milk is not just necessarily, here's the formula coming out. No, the formula will change. The actual nutrient load will vary depending on the developmental stage of the young. So milk fat content in seals, for instance, can be as high as 60%. Meanwhile, it's basically nothing in wallabies. And speaking of wallabies, according to The Origin and Evolution of Lactation by Capusso and Akers, published in 2009, quote, milk in the tamer wallaby, that's Macropus eugenii, changes from a very dilute secretion containing primarily carbohydrate during early lactation to a more energy-dense milk that contains substantial quantities of protein and fat during late phases of lactation. So that's a nice example of just how the exact details of the milk will change during the course of the young's growth.
Now, we could probably devote a whole episode or multiple episodes in the future to the study of milk, true biological mammal milk, because that's a fascinating subject on its own. But today, we wanted to focus on something even weirder, which is all of the non-mammal, quote, milk that's out there. There has been an astonishing amount of research that I had not kept up with until diving into it recently about animals you would just never expect to produce milk, producing something like milk.
Yeah, I have to say this also forced me to learn about a couple of different creatures I was not familiar with mm-hmm. that were brought to my attention solely because they produce something that one might call milk.
So this will be our anomalous milk episode. But before we get into the anomalous milk, I guess it's worth a quick look at actual mammal milk itself.
Right.
Now, I know you've done some episodes on dairy products and on mammal milk in the past, right?
Yeah, there was an older episode that I did with Julie Douglas back in the day. And then more recently, did an episode with Christian Sayer titled Holy Butter. Mm-hmm. As the name implies, it's mostly about butter and how we make butter and some of the uses we have for butter.
Did y'all talk about bog butter?
Yes, we did talk about bog butter.
Bog butter is so good.
Yeah. But we also talked about how butter and also milk is nothing short of solar energy transformed through a few different steps into a food. For instance, there's the alchemy of photosynthesis to kick things off. Mm-hmm. The grass in the field converts energy in the form of sunlight into chemical energy in the form of sugars and other carbohydrates. This is essentially the first miracle of milk. Mm-hmm. And then you have a female ruminant, in this case, cow, sheep, camel, water buffalo, goats, etc. They consume that grass. And truly, as Elaine Kosrova explores in her tremendous book, Butter, A Rich History, you're better off thinking of it as a processed harvesting rather than a meal, because ruminants are built to transform grass into milk. Consider that they have these three or four chambered stomachs. Their upper dental pad instead of teeth for masticating greens. And each animal puts its own particular chemical spin on the process as well. But they crunch up the greens and they ferment them in their mini-chambered guts. 8 hours feeding, 8 hours ruminating, and then the remains of the day resting. So that maceration, the repeated chewing of the cud, helps to carry out the second miracle of milk, the transformation of a low-fat diet of grass into high-fat milk.
Yeah, you always wonder about that, right? Like, you mm-hmm. look at the beginning product and the end product, and you're like, I don't understand exactly what's happening here.
Yeah, and part of this is just the miracle of digestion. The broken down food is assaulted by microbes in the oxygen-free fermentation chamber of the gut. The grassy meal is broken down to the basic elements, strings of carbon and hydrogen molecules, and then other bacteria recombine the elements into volatile fatty acids. Only half the fat comes from the cow's diet. The rest comes from the cow's own body fat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
so it's sort of, it's not just making a product out of what it just ate, but it's giving of itself when yeah. it creates milk.
And I think that's one of the reasons, like, we put the human layer on milk too, right? Like mm-hmm. milk is this giving of something to bring nourishment to another. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have so many metaphors related to that, including, of course, the milk of human kindness. But in this example, talking just about ruminant milk, it's a fatty liquid to ensure the survival of the animal's young. And the exact composition, again, is going to vary from species to species with additional factors depending on environment and diet. For instance, an ewe produces twice the fat content of cow milk. Goat milk has smaller, more digestible fat molecules. Yak milk has less sugar and more protein. And camel's milk has three times as much vitamin C. Water buffalo milk has twice the fat of cow milk. And then we have things that are not even, we don't traditionally think of as milk producers, but consider the whales.
Oh, yeah.
Blue whales, for instance. This always blows my mind. A newborn blue whale gains 200 pounds a day just by nursing. And the average whale produces 40 times more milk than a cow. And this has even led some scientists to consider the possibility of milking whales in specially prepared milking bays and then using that milk for human consumption.
Is there really any milk of any animal that has not been considered for human consumption?
I don't know. I mean, there's some that are certainly more attractive.
Right.
But anytime you start reading around about different milks, I feel like there's a good chance somebody's tasted it and they will tell you what the flavor profile is.
What does rat milk taste like?
Ooh.
What does monkey milk pair with?
I don't know. Ooh. I sometimes think about cat milk, like what like tiger milk would taste like. Would it be, would it have kind of a, like a meaty consistency to it? Probably not.
Like a nice French washed rind cat milk cheese.
I also, this is a topic that I discussed in that past episode with Julie, was of course the idea that you do have certain situations that can cause males to lactate as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some are more like behavioral, environmental, and others have to do with irregularities in the body. But you also have certain male fruit bats that lactate. And these are the only examples of male mammals lactating as a part of a regular parental activity.
Yeah, and you can see already in the idea of male animal lactation that there is going to be there are going to be some like asterisks next to the official like dictionary definition of milk, which is something like an opaque white fluid that's rich in fat and protein that's secreted by female mammals for the nourishment of their young. So obviously that's not quite all cases because in some cases males secrete it like the bats you're just talking about. And then I guess the question comes in where if you have something that meets all those qualifications but is not produced by a mammal, is that technically milk or not? I think a lot of biologists might say no,
mm-hmm.
but they might still use the term in describing whatever this other substance is.
What is the substance on The Simpsons that they're drinking in the school cafeteria?
I think it's rat milk.
Is it malk?
Oh, malk. Yeah. Yes. What now with vitamin R.
Yeah.
Oh, my bones, they feel so brittle. But I always drink plenty of malk.
Well, maybe it's malk. Maybe it's malk.
Well, whatever you call it, milk, malk, milk analog, there are clearly strong reasons that non-mammalian animals would have an incentive to secrete milk-like fluids that they use to feed their young. It's a really useful strategy, and it serves quite a few different functions. I mean, for one thing, it allows the parent to produce food for their offspring without having to like leave or hunt or forage. You don't have to go out of the nest. Another thing is that it tightly controls the nutritional content of the offspring's food, making sure they get exactly what they need. And you can see that in the very different nutritional profiles of milk like you were talking about earlier, like with wallabies and stuff.
It's also a way for the young to eat of the mother without actually eating the mother.
Yes, exactly. And so it can include extra nutrition, lots of fat and protein, maybe more fat and protein than you could expect to get from food sources in the environment. It's like super concentrating the nutrition profile for the young, which will help them speed up and grow faster. And then it can also deliver really important additives. Earlier, you mentioned immune function, and that does seem to be a very important role of milk in animals, the idea of stimulating the immune system with antibodies or supplementing the offspring's microbiome with microbiota-like commensal bacteria from the mother.
Yeah, I feel like this should come as no surprise following our poop-eating animals episode, because obviously if eating a little parental poop is going to provide that kind of a boost. Obviously, that kind of boost might be available via milk.
And then on top of all that, like the additives for the immune system, you also can add hormones. This can be especially useful when it's like hormones that could have something to do with cementing the psychological bond between parent and child, or things like growth hormone to help speed up the growth of the young. So with some of that in mind, it might be less surprising what I'm about to say, which is that a number of bird species secrete a substance analogous to milk. I think we should look at a few, Robert. Will you look at milk birds with me?
Let's do it.
How about pigeons?
Huh.
Pigeons, both male and female, regurgitate a highly nutritious substance known as crop milk into the mouths of their young. And don't let the fact that it is delivered in the form of nourishing barf throw you off. This is not regurgitated food. This is not the parent bird providing a partially digested version of what they just ate. Crop milk is a separate, original substance secreted in the crop organ. It's from the parent's body itself. Now, the crop organ is – I don't know if you've ever seen one of these, Robert. It's sort of a
– I have not.
It's like a pouch area in the esophagus that can be used to store and moisten food before it continues on down the alimentary tract for digestion. And I think it's thought that the crop organ is useful for like prey species of birds that might be trying to gobble up a bunch of food really fast while they're out somewhere exposed and then be able to fly off quickly and reduce the amount of time they're out there eating and exposed to predators. So you want to be able to just like stuff it all in, like get it all down there really fast and then get out of there, and then you can settle down somewhere safe and try to digest.
It's a doggy bag essentially inside the body.
Yes, exactly. It's your styrofoam clamshell inside the bird's throat. And so the crop milk, it's actually produced by pigeons and doves. This is described in a paper I'll come back to in a minute as, quote, an oily, yellowish, cheese-like substance that is formed into small, seed-sized, rice-shaped pellets. I've also seen it described as cottage cheese, but yellow.
Well, this sounds fine. I have no objection to any of that.
Okay. So apparently crop milk is produced by the inner cells of the crop pouch becoming moist and then sort of sloughing off into the pouch and then getting regurgitated. So it's like, here, son, let me barf you up some of my highly nutritious inside skin.
Okay. This is my flesh, etc.
Gotcha. Right. Now, an interesting thing in birds, in pigeons, is that this process in parent pigeons is apparently controlled by the hormone prolactin, which is also what stimulates milk production in mammals. That's kind of interesting because, you know, they don't have mammary glands. It's not – you would think that it would be something completely different, but it's prolactin in both cases that gets the parent doing this. Crop milk tends to be mostly protein and fat, about 60% protein, maybe 30-something percent fat, and then just a little bit of carbohydrates and minerals and other things in there. A 2012 study in PLOS1 by Megan Gillespie et al. Found that if you took baby chickens and fed them crop milk from pigeons, they sort of became like little minor Hulk chickens. After just 7 days, the pigeon milk chickens were more than 12% heavier than control chickens, and also they showed greater diversity of gut bacteria, specifically in the cecum, and they had higher expression of the immunoglobulin IgA, which is an antibody class that's crucial for all kinds of immune system function. Now, a side question you might be wondering is, why did they test this on chickens rather than on pigeons? I think the answer is that with pigeons, you couldn't really have a control group because young pigeons would just die without the crop milk. Mm-hmm. And there, I've read that there have been other studies that looked into this. They're like fed pigeon crop milk to chickens to see what happened. And the chickens always really beefed up. It's like it's clearly something that their bodies respond well to. But there are some other birds that also produce and feed their young with secretions from the upper digestive tract that are crop milk or something like it. Flamingos would be an example. I was reading about the flamingo crop milk feeding on the San Diego Zoo website. They were talking about their flamingos.
Oh, yeah. They have a great website, great outreach.
Yeah, exactly. And so a few things they mentioned. One is that apparently when young chicks, flamingo chicks are hungry and they're calling out for feeding – it's not just their own parents. Other adults in the flock can be stimulated to act as sort of foster feeders, which is sweet. That's cool. And the way that seems to work is that they suppose that hearing the sound of the hungry chicks calling for food stimulates the production of the milk-like analog. And then also one of the things they say is that as the parent flamingos produce crop milk to feed their chicks, their feathers tend to be drained of color over time. So like if you've got an adult that's producing crop milk feeding a young one, it turns from pink to a pale pink or even to a white. And then after they stop producing it, they gradually get their color back. One more, of course, is emperor penguins. You may have heard about this. Like, you know, the male emperor penguins guarding the egg while the female goes off to feed. So that goes on. But what happens if the young penguin hatches from the egg before the female returns from feeding with fish to regurgitate for it? Apparently, the male penguin will do something like this, will generate some upper digestive tract milk to barf out for the little penguin, and the little penguin gets its nourishment that way.
Huh. So again, it's certainly not milk, but it does seem to be meeting some of the criteria we've discussed.
Well, it's a lot like milk nutritionally. It seems to serve a lot of the same functions and be composed in a pretty similar way. So I don't know. I don't know whether you should call it milk or not. I mean, again, I think if we go by the technical definition, milk is only produced by mammals, so it's not milk. But it looks like milk. It apparently tastes like milk. It does what milk does.
Yeah, we could call it bird milk or bird nog. I kind of like that.
Bird nog.
If we want to give it a holiday twist.
That's good. Well, how about let me take you to the next step. This one might seem unbelievable, but maybe just a tiny bit less so given that birds produce milk-like secretions. What about dino nog?
Ooh.
So what are birds? They are the dinosaurs that survived the fifth extinction, right? They're the descendants of these feathered dinosaurs that survived when the thing that killed all the other dinosaurs. Now, given that modern birds exhibit a form of what might be considered lactation, is it possible that some dinosaurs also fed their young with milk-like secretions? We don't know the answer to this, but exactly this question is explored by the Australian molecular biologist Paul Else in a 2013 Journal of Experimental Biology paper called Dinosaur Lactation? It's like Chariots of the Gods. You know, if you end it with a question mark, you're always safe.
It's not in all caps, though, I will say that.
That is a good point. But this is a fun question. So he says, you know, if dinosaurs did perform something analogous to lactation, we don't know. But if they did, it's another one of the many soft tissue-based biological features that are just going to be extremely difficult to infer from fossilized remains. The bones don't usually tell us things like that. So the only way to try to answer this kind of question is to look at the indirect evidence. And so he's got a few thoughts here. One of them is about the initial size difference between adults and hatchlings of some dinosaur species.
Especially the sauropods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he says like, it almost seems as if it would present mechanical problems in feeding. He said to – I believe this was to a campus newspaper. He was speaking about his paper too. Quote, although I work at the molecular level, I'm basically a comparative physiologist. And one thing that always struck me as unresolved about dinosaurs was how a dinosaur parent of several tons could feed young of only a few kilograms. It seemed obvious, a form of lactation similar to that present in birds. Hmm. And then in his paper, he writes, quote, lactation might free large parents from having to feed their newly hatched young the regurgitated products of their own meals that might be unsuited for altricial young based on digestive systems unfamiliar with coarse fodder, like, you know, rough plant matter that adults would be eating. and essential nutrient requirements to promote rapid growth, and replace this with secretory products – oh, that's a hard word – secretory synthesized by the foregut that are more suited to supporting rapid development. So again, there's obviously some kind of incentive there would be if they could produce something like this. We don't know if they could. So if we entertain that possibility for a second, the dinosaurs produced milk for their young, it's likely they did it in the same way as birds rather than like mammals do. So that would probably mean nutrient-rich secretions from the upper digestive tract that would be barfed up into the little dinosaurs' mouths. And paleontologists have discovered evidence that many dinosaur hatchlings grew very quickly. We do seem to have evidence for that, closer to the growth rate of birds and mammals than of reptiles. And a nutrient-rich parental secretion, especially if it contained these helpful bioadditives like antibodies and growth hormone, as it does in the case of some birds, could help explain this rapid growth. But unfortunately, there's currently no direct evidence for dinosaur milk. Maybe in the future, some paleontologist will come up with a clever way of proving that dinosaurs made crop milk. That would be awesome.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's if we ever get Jurassic Park, that's one of the things that we can also achieve, a chance to sample all the various dinosaur milks. I wonder which one would you prefer if you had to have some dinosaur nog? Which species?
Oh, I'd probably want to go with a herbivore milk. I don't know if I'd want to try out a carnivorous dinosaur milk.
Yeah. I think I'd probably go for what Parasaurolophus. I feel like that one looks like a good milk dino.
Yo, how about Pachycephalosaurus?
Ooh, yeah, the big cranial headbutters.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
I think those are good choices that lend themselves to certain branding. You know, like one is kind of like the brain milk. You know, you really want to smack craniums with your coworkers. Well, then you need a bone up on this stuff.
How about Triceranog?
Ooh, Triceranog is good. Yeah,
we'll come back to it. This is one I'm going to keep my eye on for years. I'm always going to have it in the back of my mind, waiting for that paper that says dinosaurs did have crop organs. They produced milk. All right, should we take a quick break?
Let's do it.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
What are you looking for in a new smart TV? 4K picture quality? High quality and immersive sound? A sleek design? All of those are givens, but only the new Roku Pro Series has all of those and the Roku streaming experience and award-winning OS. Get fast, easy access to all your apps like iHeart, where you can stream all your favorite music, radio, and podcasts all day. And regular all-inclusive trips to Roku City. The new Roku Pro Series, a smart TV built by the streaming pros.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Dad deserves something really nice for Father's Day, but let's face it, we usually don't do it. Big gifts are for Mother's Day.
Picking something up on the way is for Father's Day. Well, let's make Father's Day something this year with the Bartesian Cocktail Maker. It whips up over 60 premium cocktails on demand, each ready at the push of a button. And right now, you get $50 off the Bartesian Cocktail Maker when you buy one pack of Dad's favorite cocktail capsules. Dad will publicly love that you saved $50 on the countertop machine that crafts premium cocktails on demand. And he'll secretly love that you splurged on him for Father's Day with the gift of a Bartesian. Because the only thing that lets Dad know he's the world's number one dad better than a world's number one dad coffee mug is an artisan cocktail in his hand. Make Dad's Father's Day and Father's Day cocktails with all natural juices and bitters without making any mess at all. Visit bartesian.com/father to get $50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
All right, we're back. We're talking about strange milk, milk-like substances produced by non-mammalian creatures.
Now, remember in the episode we did about amphibians with special guest Mark Mandica, he was discussing these amazing creatures called Caecilians, not the people from Sicily.
Right.
But it is spelled C-A-E-C-I-L-I-A-N. Caecilians are amphibians like frogs and salamanders, but unlike frogs and salamanders, Caecilians are completely without legs. Most Caecilians live underground, so we rarely see them. And if you do see one, you might mistake it for a huge worm. They kind of look like moist, greasy snakes.
So they're sounding more and more like just like an awesome candidate for milk-like substance production.
Right. So can you milk a Caecilian? Not exactly, but they do provide their young with nourishing secretions that are sort of milk analogs. There was a paper by Alexander Kupfer and a bunch of other authors, Alexander Kupfer et al., published in Nature in 2006 called Parental Investment by Skin Feeding in a Caecilian Amphibian. The short version of this is that after the mother of a Caecilian species called Boulangerulia titanus, after she gives birth, she transforms the outer layer of her skin into a nutrient-rich meal for her young offspring. Hmm. And then the young develop, quote, a specialized dentition, which they use to peel and eat the outer layer of their mother's modified skin. So basically, mom turns her skin into cheese, and these juvenile worm-like creatures develop special baby teeth that are designed specifically for eating mom's milk skin.
What I love about this example is that not only is it kind of delightfully grotesque and again, weirder than anything we could dream up for our horror movies, it also, even though it's not milk, it is a milk-like behavior, it forces you to reevaluate what milk is as a mammalian feature.
Yeah. Well, are you saying that even among mammals, we should think about it more like this parent is just ripping off part of their body to give to their young?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I have heard mothers, nursing mothers, like speak of it in this way, you know, where they are. And I would love to hear from anyone out there who's had this experience where they're like, this is so bizarre. Like I'm basically turning my body into this substance and feeding this little larval human creature. You know, I have frequently heard mothers speak about the weirdness of the whole scenario. But I feel like it is a weird – there is something about milk that for the rest of the time and for many of us, we just take it for granted.
Yeah, it's amazing. We forget to appreciate the weirdness of reality in so many ways, but this is another one of them. It's crazy. It's amazing. It's around us every day. It's a whole aisle at the grocery store, and it's a crucial part of human life. And when you just stop and appreciate the biological realities of it, it is startling. Oh, but one thing I wanted to address about the Caecilians here. So I want to read a quote from the abstract. So, quote, this new form of parental care provides a plausible intermediate stage in the evolution of viviparity, which is live birth, in Caecilians. At independence, offspring of viviparous and oviparous, which means egg-laying, dermatotrophic, which means skin-eating, Caecilians, are relatively large despite being provided with relatively little yolk. The specialized dentition of skin-feeding or dermatophagous Caecilians may constitute a pre-adaptation to the fetal feeding on the oviduct lining of viviparous Caecilians. So that's a lot of Latin words. But In other words, the eggs have the advantage of containing a yolk that the young can feed on. And of course, this is why egg yolks are delicious. It's everything a growing body needs. And live birth instead has the young develop and feed inside the mother until they're viable to move around and survive on their own. Species whose young have this intermediate stage where eating their mother's butter skin as a yolk substitute or a supplement could be an evolutionary stepping stone between these two kinds of birth.
Huh. Yeah. So this – and also this connection between what yolk essentially is and what milk essentially is. It's like the offspring is spat out. It's like, whoa, mom, there wasn't enough yolk there. Oh, don't worry. I have something that is like yolk that I will now produce for you to consume.
It is very much like yolk, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, both are involved in eggnog, so there's your holiday connection.
Think about the nutritional parallels between egg yolks mm-hmm. and milk. They tend to be high in protein, high in fat, good for growing young bodies.
Yes, both useful in making like a frothy mixed drink, like a Ramos Gin Fizz or something.
Wait, is that egg yolk or egg white?
That is usually just the egg white.
Okay.
Though, there are other drinks that call for the egg yolk as well. I haven't experimented with as many of those. And, of course, there are plenty of drinks that also call for milk. Eggnog is a great example of that because that is often paired with some sort of a liquor.
What's that drink called where you just have a beer and you crack an egg in it?
Oh, I don't know. Is that like
they drink it on The Wire, I think.
I don't remember the name of that one.
It's the dock workers.
Yeah, Breakfast of Champions or something.
Never tried it. All right, Robert, have you got some strange milk for us?
Yeah. So, we're talking about birds. It only, makes sense that we would also turn to the world of fish.
Ah, okay.
So, in particular, we're talking about the discus fish, which is an Amazonian cichlid species. It's a rather unique fish because both mother and father provide sustenance for their hatchlings via mucus secretions.
Mm.
And, of course, this isn't simply a matter of hatchlings like nipping some mucus from their parents and then swimming off. This can go on for a month or so.
Oh, wow. So it's prolonged, yeah.
Yeah. So it's worth remembering that with a fish – slime and mucus or mucus, they're very important. It's not merely the stuff that's on their scales, but it constitutes a protective outer layer of their bodies. And it provides a number of key benefits. One of the big ones that's going to be important here is osmoregulation or gas transport. And this is to maintain the internal-external osmotic balance, also sometimes referred to dermal respiration. In addition to this, the mucus or slime provides external protection. It can reduce turbulence. And there are other varieties of fish that also use it as a toxin-rich outer coating, so it can be protective. Even if it doesn't have toxins in it, it can provide some level of protection. Mm-hmm. You have other particularly slimy fish like the hagfish that use it to their advantage. Mucus also can serve for water cleansing purposes. It can also serve a purpose in cocoon formation in the case of the African lungfish. And some fish also eat their own mucus.
Hmm.
So a 2010 study looked into this. It was titled Biparental Mucus Feeding, a Unique Example of Parental Care in an Amazonian Cichlid by Buckley et al., published in the Journal of Experimental Biology. So basically, they broke down not only the nutrient and immunity load of the mucus, but also how it all changed depending on the developmental level of the offspring, very much in line with the milk production of mammals, as we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Again, remember how milk changes to meet the growing offspring's needs. The authors pointed out that like the peak level of mucus antibody provision was seen as offspring reached the free-swimming stage. And this suggested a role that's very much like what is provided by mammals again. So there's a weaning off here.
Hmm.
They pointed out that the protein was lowest during the second and third weeks of free-swimming during a weaning period. And the authors point out that all of this is far more in line with mammalian and avian parental care than anything we see in other fish. So it's a rather curious example of, it's not milk. It's a little more like the Sicilian example in that we're dealing with an outer layer of the creature's skin.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's providing sustenance for the young and doing so, again, not in just an offhand manner like the hatchlings are out and then they just, grab a bite and run off.
Right. It seems like we're steadily progressing further and further from mammals. Like we went to birds and dinosaurs, then we went to amphibians, and then we went to fish, which are still vertebrates, right? How much further could we get?
Yeah, because it's one of those things where if you just came up to somebody on the street and just surprised them and said, hey, have you ever tried bird milk? They might be like, oh, I don't know. And it might take them just a few seconds to be like, hey, wait a second. Uh-huh. Only mammals produce milk. But when you start talking about fish milk or insect milk, I think most people aren't going to buy it for a second. They're going to say, you're a crazy person. Stop talking about things that don't exist.
Let me talk about things that do exist. Robert, go on a mental journey with me. Imagine you are sitting on a park bench in a park somewhere in southern China. Mm-hmm. And you feel a tickle on your forearm.
Okay.
You look down. There's an ant crawling on you. It has a shiny, segmented black body with antennae wiggling in the breeze. But then you look closer. Those aren't antennae. They're not coming out of the top of its head. They're coming out of the thorax under the head, or the cephalothorax. They're legs, which means this animal has not six but eight legs. This is not an ant. It is a spider. It's a spider in disguise.
Ooh, nice.
This is the spider Toxaeus magnus. I've included a picture for you to look at here, Robert. And I like the way, even in this close-up, the shiny black body is like catching a fluorescent light on the ceiling that you can see very clearly.
Yeah, and it looks very much like an ant. At first glance, you would just assume this is an ant. You really have to stare at it for a second to make out all the legs.
Yeah. So it's about a centimeter long, Toxaeus magnus, and it's a member of the family Salticidae, the jumping spiders. Magnus is also known as the black ant mimicking jumper, which needs a catchier name, and it's found mostly in Southeast Asia. Now, there are hundreds of species of spider that are professional ant mimics like this. They're known as the myrmecomorphs, and they not only look like ants, but they often mimic the behaviors and movement patterns of ants, even lifting and waving their front legs around to make them look like antennae, or walking on or walking in patterns that copy the locomotion of foraging ants. And you can imagine several reasons spiders might want to look like ants. That the main pressure actually driving this evolutionary path seems to be the avoidance of certain egg sac parasites like spider wasps and predators like mantises and other larger jumping spiders, which kill spiders but usually leave ants alone.
That makes sense, right? I mean, because, of course, obviously you have all these species that have evolved to prey upon spiders. Mm-hmm. But associating yourself with the ants, it's kind of that's a safer bet because the ants have strength in numbers and they're not the solitary prey that a spider would be.
Right. Or they might just not be nutritious to eat or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be all kinds of reasons that a predator doesn't really want to go mess with an ant.
Yeah.
So just a few weeks ago, a group of researchers mostly based in China, led by a researcher named Jianqi Chen, published a study in the journal Science revealing something amazing about these ant-mimic spiders. It started with the observation that after the young Magnus spiders hatch from their eggs, they sort of became like what you might call indoor children. Instead of leaving the nest, they hung around for a long time, roughly 20 days. And then it gets weirder because not only did they not leave the nest to forage, the mother spider didn't leave the nest to forage either. So it couldn't have been going out to get food to bring back to them. Nobody left home or even went out to the grocery store for almost 3 weeks. And if you know something about spiders, you'll probably recognize that there's something odd going on here. Like there are some social species of arachnid, but this shouldn't be one of them. Most spiders, including generally salticids, the jumping spiders, are aggressive and even cannibalistic toward one another. So they don't nest together like this except for those small number of social species. What's weirder, during this period of family time, the young spiders grew a lot. If they were growing, they had to be eating. So what were they eating if nobody ever left the nest? You can probably guess where we're going with this. The authors started watching more closely just what was happening in the nest, and what they found was strange and fascinating. During the first week after hatching, the mother spider would secrete droplets of an unknown white milk-like fluid from a ridge on her underbelly called the epigastric furrow. This is also where the spider's eggs are produced, interestingly. And so after she secreted this fluid, she would leave droplets of it on the walls of the nest for her offspring to eat. And after the first week, the young spiders would just climb right up on her and drink the secretions directly from the Mother Magnus's epigastric furrow.
Hmm.
So this milk substance feeding took place for the first 40 days of the young spiders' lives. Even after the young spiders finally started leaving the nest to hunt, they would come back. They would come back to the nest and supplement their insect diet by getting more spider milk from the mother.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. So the researchers also found that when the spiders were unable to feed their young with this spider milk, all the young spiders died within less than 2 weeks. So it's not just a little something extra. It's necessary for the life cycle of the species. And the spider milk they found is incredibly nutritious. They found that per milliliter, it contained 2 milligrams of sugar, 5.2 milligrams of fat, and 124 milligrams of protein, which is a lot. That's
yes.
expressed as 4 times the protein content of cow's milk. And of course, I envision an awesome future whenever we finally chuck it in and just start hawking bogus nutrition supplements to bodybuilders. We're going to do the spider milk protein bomb stack.
I love this. I really want to incorporate this into Dungeons and Dragons because you have various species, particularly in the Underdark,
mm-hmm.
The vast subterranean realm in the setting that depend on spiders. The Grey Dwarves, the Durgar, they have these kind of like pack pony spiders that they use.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that they would be drinking some sort of spider milk. And now there's a scientific reason to incorporate that into everyone's campaigns.
Doesn't science always end up proving the D&D Monster Manual correct?
It does. Yeah, it does.
One of the co-authors on this paper, Richard T. Cortlett, says, quote, "Our findings suggest that lactation may arise in non-mammals when it provides a significant advantage in offspring survival." Well, as we've been seeing from the other examples in this episode, that's clearly true. He also says that it's useful in this species because of the small size of the hatchlings. They're tiny and unable to hunt, or at least initially unable to hunt or defend themselves from predators. But ultimately, the researchers don't know why this strange mammal-like trait has evolved in this one species of spider. As far as we know, at least so far, this is the only spider that does this. And it's very weird. And another thing that was pointed out that was pretty weird is that the mother Magnus didn't just offer her milk to the young. She also displays like social parenting behaviors, like maintaining a clean and safe nest environment for the young to hang out in.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of weird for spiders.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll keep having some arachnid milk.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
What are you looking for in a new smart TV? 4K picture quality? High quality and immersive sound? A sleek design? All of those are givens, but only the new Roku Pro Series has all of those and the Roku streaming experience and award-winning OS. Get fast, easy access to all your apps like iHeart, where you can stream all your favorite music, radio, and podcasts all day. And regular all-inclusive trips to Roku City. The new Roku Pro Series. A smart TV built by the streaming pros.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all-natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
All right, we're back. Robert, are you going to feed me with the milk of arachnids?
Yes, yes. We have another arachnid species here that's producing something that's kind of like milk. So we're talking about the pseudoscorpion.
Nice.
Now, the pseudoscorpion really sounds like something that Jorge Luis Borges would have just made up.
Uh-huh.
It's a tiny arachnid that can frequently be found living in old books, protecting them from decay by feasting on book lice that munch on the starch-based bookbinding glue.
That is good.
Yeah. I mean, it really does sound like something that Borges would have made up. Like, oh, well, the old books are home to these tiny creatures, and they eat other tiny creatures that want to destroy the books. I don't know. There's something beautiful about it.
Yeah. It's like something that would have been imagined in the marginal illustrations in one of the scripts in Name of the Rose.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And they do literally live in the margins, so yeah. It makes sense.
But if you see them, they look kind of like scorpions without tails, like they
right.
got claws.
Yeah, they're sometimes called false scorpions because they are, in fact, not scorpions despite having these big pinchers. They have some really impressive-looking pinchers. And there are some 3,300 species of false scorpion that live around the world, but the most famous is Chelipher cancroides, which can reach 4 millimeters in length. So I was reading about this. The author Beck Crew has a wonderful post about them on the Scientific American blog titled "How Book Scorpions Tend to Your Dusty Tomes." And she discusses, among other things, their dancing and rubbing mating rituals, which sound quite cute, but then it gets really kind of weird and brutal. Quote, "He dumps a sack full of sperm on the ground." And it gets worse because then he pushes the female down into his sack full of sperm on the ground. This whole process can take anywhere from 10 minutes to a whole hour. The sack full of sperm will be taken in by the female's genital orifice, and she'll end up producing 20 to 40 eggs, which she'll carry around in her abdomen even after they've hatched.
Well, that's weird sex.
Yes, yeah. So everything gets a little less Borges and a little more, I don't know, Giger, I guess.
Yeah.
But here's where we get to the sweet book scorpion milk. So the larvae will hang around, and the young book scorpions will even hang out around on her back until they're old enough to go off on their own. But as larvae, they remain inside for a while, living in her genital orifice and feeding on a milk-like substance that secretes from her ovaries.
Hmm.
So they feast on this stuff, and eventually she's just so emaciated from the consumption that the tiny book scorpions just have to leave. Like they can no longer hang out in the orifice because there's just not enough book scorpion milk to go around anymore.
Ungrateful.
Well, you know, she does a lot. She does what she can, and then they have to move on and eat some book lice.
Somebody ought to whip some independence into those baby book scorpions. Get them eating book lice earlier.
Now, I have another couple of creatures to mention here. These are insects, mm-hmm. But they also illustrate what's going on. So bat flies. I was not familiar with bat flies, but they are fascinating little creatures. They are, as the name implies, parasites that feed on bats.
Mm-hmm.
They do not, however, look much like a traditional fly. Whatever you're imagining when I say bat fly, it ain't that.
Are we going to try to say the family name of the bat flies? Is it Nycteribidae?
Yes, I think that would be my guess, Nycteribidae. They are wingless, spider-like insects with long legs and a small head that folds back into a groove in the thorax when it rests. So earlier we had a spider that kind of looks like an insect. Here we have an insect that kind of looks like a spider.
Huh.
They also have a highly developed uterus and milk glands, or at least they were referred to as milk glands, so milk in quotation marks here. And these glands seem to play a key role in imparting important bacterial endosymbionts to the offspring. And other insects engage in this kind of behavior as well, as they host bacteria in their cells that provide important boosts that food alone cannot give them. These endosymbionts are essential. For example, the tsetse fly hosts a bacterium that provides B vitamins that are not available in the fly's normal diet of blood.
Isn't it amazing how, like, we think that animals rule the world, but like almost all animals are just so dependent on invisible microbes in order to even just get the basic nutrition they need out of their food.
Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, again, this is a great example of just like, it's almost like a simple model of milk. Hey, baby, you're just going to only eat blood, but there are things you need. Mm-hmm. I will have to provide them through some handy secretions.
Well, there's another insect secretion I want to talk about.
Oh, what kind of yummy milk do you have for us now?
It's cockroach milk time.
Oh.
So you're not a fan of cockroaches, are you?
Do you know anyone who is?
Oh, I'm sure there are lots of people who love cockroaches.
I mean, hissing cockroaches are kind of cool. I think cockroaches are only interesting if they are exotic or they are pets. Nobody wants just free-range cockroaches or palmetto bugs, as you know, we regionally call the larger ones that invade our homes.
Yeah.
Nobody wants those around.
They're inescapable around here.
Inescapable, and I feel like we have an instant kill instinct with them.
Yeah.
No matter how much – you have to be pretty hardcore animal lover to say, oh – the palmetto bug is here. Let me attend to its needs.
But smashing one of those Georgia cockroaches is basically like smashing like a 3-foot-wide jellyfish. Like it leaves this explosion of mucus and liquid everywhere. They mm-hmm. are so big and so juicy.
Yeah, and they like to hang out. I've noticed it sometimes tauntingly on white walls.
Yeah,
they're like, oh, I can't squish you there because there will be the mark will haunt me forever.
You ever walk into the bathroom in the middle of the night, turn the light on, and there's a cockroach on your toothbrush?
No, I haven't.
It's happened to me.
Oh, I have not encountered that. But now I have that image in my head. Now I will fear it. I do frequently.
You never know.
I do frequently notice how I'll go into a room. It might be the kitchen or wherever, and you turn on the light, and it's not. You don't always necessarily see the roach. All at once, but suddenly something clicks in your mind, like mm-hmm. there's something is off, like and then you have to look for it, and then you find it, you know. But we have like a high level of awareness for them.
So there is a species of cockroach found in Asia and in the Pacific Islands. I think it's found a lot in Hawaii, known as the Pacific beetle cockroach or Diploptera punctata. And there are several interesting things about the species of cockroach. First of all, they are the only known truly viviparous cockroach, the only cockroach we know of that has real live birth instead of laying eggs.
Huh.
Second, this is kind of interesting, they do chemical warfare. They produce an organic compound that's known as quinones from specialized tracheal glands. And this is probably a chemical weapon they use against predators. There are analogies for this, like quinones are used as part of the chemical defense of the bombardier beetle. And then finally, researchers have discovered that this cockroach who gives live birth to its young also secretes a type of protein-rich, light yellow, milk-like liquid from her brood sac, and then the young ones drink it.
Okay. Tell me more about this roach nog.
Well, one of the researchers who first discovered this was the University of Iowa emeritus biologist and insect surgeon, Dr. Barbara Stay.
Insect surgeon.
Yeah. How do you become an insect surgeon? That sounds like an awesome job.
Very delicate hands.
Yes. You got to be like so many steps above like the human neurosurgeon to be an insect surgeon. So the cockroach milk begins as a liquid at first, and it contains these milk crystals that are full of nutritious proteins and stuff. And then as the young grow, the milk begins to sort of like solidify into bigger solid crystals. And Dr. Stay apparently developed a process for, quote, milking these cockroaches. Speaking to NPR, she described the process, I guess, pretty simply. She said, quote, you substitute a filter paper in the brood sac for the embryos and you leave it there. After a while, you take it out and you get the milk.
Okay. So it's kind of like you stuff a washcloth into the roach, and then eventually you take it out and wring it out.
That's about right. So you may have seen some articles about this a couple years ago, because there was a new study in 2016 analyzing the contents of this cockroach milk. And this study was done by a team led by the Indian biochemist Subramanian Ramaswamy. And the researchers found that it was super nutritious. Quote, a single crystal is estimated to contain more than three times the energy of an equivalent mass of dairy milk. This unique storage form of nourishment for developing embryos allows access to a constant supply of complete nutrients.
Huh.
And by the way, of course, the way this was covered in the press was there was just headline after headline in CNN and everywhere saying that cockroach milk is the next superfood.
I'm not grossed out by that. I will say, as grossed out as I am by roaches usually, I think that falls in line with a lot of what we've been seeing about the consumption of insects. Insects is a protein source.
Oh, absolutely.
The future is going to be a place where either you eat the bugs or the bugs eat you.
Entomophagy is the future. Mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, it is a healthy source of protein that's, I think, going to be an incredibly important meat substitute in on future Earth.
I have to give a quick shout out to the Audubon Society's Insectarium in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful museum with so many different live insect species and some arachnid species to check out. But they also have an area where every time you go, you get to try a few different food items that have been prepared with insect protein.
Mm.
And
did you try them?
Oh, I do it every time.
Did you like it?
Yeah, well, they really try and make sure that it's something that you will and can eat, you know. So it's generally something sweet, you know, that kids are going to be into. Essentially, you know, cookies topped with mealworms, that sort of a thing. I think it's very instructional and insightful, and I'm super glad that they do that and provide that kind of you know, educational content in addition to just learning about these different insect and arachnid species.
I didn't write down what the reference for this was, but I did look at a press release about a study that found that if you wanted to get people – I think what it was if you wanted to get people to agree to eating insects, you couldn't just appeal to the idea that it was better for the environment or that it was nutritious. You had to convince them that it was a delicious delicacy.
Hmm.
And if you could do that, they would eat the insects.
Hmm. Interesting. I would love to look at this topic more and see what people were doing along those lines. Because we often come back to the fact that, like, what's the difference ultimately between eating various types of insects and eating shrimp or crawdads or what have you?
Oh, yeah, lobster. Yeah, mm-hmm. Lobster. Why is that different?
Yeah. So, I would love to talk about eating insects more in the future. But I've gotten off topic here. Let's get back to that delicious roach nog.
Well, so I brought that up just to say that it's probably not true that cockroach milk is the next superfood. I think those were just some headline grabbers.
Yeah.
Number one, we don't know that the milk is safe for human consumption. Humans can often become allergic to cockroaches. We don't have a way of milking them at any kind of volume. So it is really interesting research nonetheless, though, a couple of reasons. But generally, it has to do with the idea of studying the proteins in these crystals in the roach milk to see if they can be replicated in other production scenarios, say by E. coli or by yeast, in ways that could deliver better technologies for medicine or nutrition. And I was reading an interesting blog post by a biologist or an entomologist named Joe Ballinger. And in this post, he pointed out that the real discovery here was that there's this protein structure in the cockroach milk that includes a protein that kind of serves as a delivery pocket that could be used in other contexts to shuttle drugs or substances around inside the body. And of course, that's relevant anytime you've got some kind of delivery or micro-delivery system that's relevant to future medicines. As for taste, on the other hand, reportedly one of Ramaswamy's colleagues tried the cockroach milk on a dare, I think maybe because he lost a drinking game or something, and quote, he said it doesn't taste like anything special.
Well, I wonder how much he drank though. Like essentially if he just – it was like a – you know, he dabbed a tiny you know, droplet of it, or if he had like a full milk glass of the stuff.
Like he drank a quart of it.
Yeah. I imagine he just –
this came from a million cockroaches.
The milk of a million cockroaches. It does sound lovely, doesn't it? Well, Well, that's it for our sampling of non-mammalian milks to discuss here. You know, we didn't even get into some of the fictional milks out there that have been consumed. How about those creatures in the most recent Star Wars film?
Oh, in The Last Jedi, where Luke Skywalker is drinking, is it green or is it blue milk that comes out?
I think it's blue.
Yeah. Oh, that's like the best scene. I loved that. It kind of made the movie for me.
Yeah, I enjoyed that film.
I did too.
You know, another one that comes to mind, it's been a long time since I've seen this, but the David Cronenberg adaptation of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, I believe the mudwump creatures in that film secreted some sort of substance that was consumed by various characters.
Mm-hmm.
Been a while since I've seen it. I don't exactly remember what the whole deal was there.
I must confess, I've never seen it.
Oh, it's interesting. Uh-huh. The book is a classic of its generation. But offhand, I can't think of any other, key like alien milks or monster milks in cinema or fiction. Though this would be a good thing to call out to our listeners about. What are some of your favorite or at least notable examples of non-mammalian, fictional creature milks out there? And indeed, I want to know what dinosaur milks other people would like to consume.
Now, as I said earlier in this episode, while I've really enjoyed exploring this anomalous non-mammalian milk, we could probably do a whole show in the future just on the magic of true milk, of mammal milk.
Oh, yes.
It is a fascinating subject, and there's a lot we didn't even have time to talk about today.
Likewise, I would love to do an episode that goes more in depth on cockroaches.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a whole lot there that we didn't even touch on here today, or squash beneath our boot.
They're six-legged saints.
All right. Well, we thank you for listening to this episode in which we discuss the milk of the six-legged saint. And we hope you'll tune in some more. We have a couple of other holiday episodes coming up, more than I expected. But I think I'm embracing the holidays a little more this year.
You've been leaning in.
I have.
The people out there, you're going to be surprised at all the stuff Robert has wanted to talk about this month.
I think I'm giving in to the holidays this year. I finally realized that it's not courage to fight it. It's courage to give in to. Paraphrase a quote from one of my favorite holiday films, Ravenous. Hey, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind or keep an eye out for new ones, head on over to the mothership, stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes, links out to our various social media accounts. And there's also a button at the top of the page for our store. That's our TeePublic store where you'll find all sorts of cool shirts, stickers, throw pillows, tote bags, you name it, has logos for the show and also some other cool designs like Cambrian Life logo, the Skug, King of the Rats, All Hail the Great Basilisk, all that sort of stuff. It's a great way to support the show. But if you want to support the show without spending a dime, rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. It really helps us out.
Big thanks, as always, to our super awesome audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other, or would like to suggest a topic for the future, or just get in touch and say hi, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
What are you looking for in a new smart TV? 4K picture quality? High quality and immersive sound? A sleek design? All of those are givens, but only the new Roku Pro Series has all of those and the Roku streaming experience and award-winning OS. Get fast, easy access to all your apps like iHeart, where you can stream all your favorite music, radio, and podcasts all day. And regular all-inclusive trips to Roku City. The new Roku Pro Series. A smart TV built by the streaming pros.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you did
it. And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.